For 13 straight days, there were reports of at least 8 tornadoes in America. Many of those were here in the Midwest. Today, why is this happening and how to talk about it, especially with kids? Plus, speaking of kids, what do children actually need to get a good education and what stands in their way? A new report from the Erickson Institute looks into early childhood well-being. And Alex Panko is a Chicago native who recently got back from climbing Mount Everest during a deadly climbing season. We'll hear about his experience.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, in for Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, Alex Panko recently came back to Chicago after summiting Mount Everest during a dangerous climbing season. We'll speak with him. And we'll also dive into a new report about what childhood well-being looks like across the state. But first, when it comes to the weather, the spring has not been an easy one. Just last week, authorities linked the death of at least 7 people to tornadoes. And the federal government has reported more than 500 tornadoes in a 30-day period, which they say may turn out to be unprecedented. Many of these tornadoes have touched down here in the Midwest in places like Indiana and Ohio and closer to home with reports near Joliet and Peoria. So what do we need to know about this extreme season of storms and how should we be talking to our families about it? Eric Snodgrass is the senior atmospheric scientist at AgNutrient. He joins us now. Hi, Eric. Welcome back to the show.
Yeah, hi. How you doing?
Doing well, thanks. And from our partner station, WGLT, is Leandra Paris. She's an assistant professor of psychology at Illinois State University. Leandra, welcome to the 21st.
Good morning.
Eric, we'll start with you. The past couple of weeks has certainly seen unusually high storm activity, and over Memorial Day there were reports of over 50 twisters that may have touched down across the Midwest and central United States. What can you tell us about what was happening that day?
Yeah, you know, really since the middle of May, we've been into a pattern in the flow of the jet stream that's featured two things that make storm chasers very happy and make the rest of us very worried, and that is a feature where we have a deep, what's called a trough, that's where the jet stream dips south over the southwest United States, and a big ridge where the jet stream bulges north over the southeast. And what that does is that provides the main ingredients for a severe weather outbreak. We have plenty of Gulf moisture. We have triggers in the atmosphere. We're talking about like fronts and things like that. And there's an abundant amount of instability. And we basically got ourselves into that pattern throughout much of the month of May, but really especially in the last 2 weeks of May. And it was just round after round after round of storms such that we are now at 132% of normal on our tornado account, and we had actually over 762 tornado warnings, so not actual tornado, but tornado warnings, 762 of those at the end of May. So yeah, the pattern was set up just to unlock the atmosphere to be producing these powerful storms.
And how much did meteorologists know ahead of that busy Memorial Day weekend of storms?
Yeah, you know, when we think about our ability to forecast events like tornadoes, to be honest with you, to pinpoint their exact location, it's impossible. What we can do in the days leading up to event is try to identify the main ingredients that are necessary to come together to make these types of storms. But there's always a lot of uncertainty, and pinpointing, again, where they're going to form is very challenging. Identifying the pattern that could lead to a lot of severe weather, well, many of us were talking about that way back in February and March, and especially in April, that, hey, it looked as though as we got into later spring that this particular setup, again, that southwestern trough and southeastern ridge was going to be a main setup we were going to have for the month of May. So it's all about the time scale and what you're talking about. But to be able to predict when and where these storms are going to hit and how they're going to hit, that is one of the beauties of Mother Nature. That's chaos. That's what we call a nonlinear system, and they are very challenging to predict. But we can monitor them, and we certainly saw quite a bit of activity over the last 3 or 4 weeks.
And just how remarkable is this tornado season turning out to be?
Well, it's remarkable, I think, for two reasons. First, we've come off of several seasons in a row. In other words, the last few years, well, we have been relatively below average on tornado activity. And so when we get this season that comes in that's just so violent and so many, you know, it is it's incredible. But put it in perspective, this year is still sitting in third place in the last decade. 2008, in 2011 were much more active years than 2019 have been. So we have to go back. That's a lot of years back to see a season that kind of approaches what we've seen right now. So I have a feeling it's catching a lot of people off guard. And, you know, when you don't deal with this kind of stuff every day, when all of a sudden it ramps up, it really kind of changes our perception of it.
Leander, let's bring you into the conversation here. You're a professor of psychology who specializes in crisis response. And when those warnings come on television or on your phone or radio, of course, it can be pretty alarming. When you hear that an emergency situation like a tornado is coming, how do most people react to that?
Usually there's that basic fight or flight response. So most people are like, do I leave the room? Like, what do I do? There's a little bit of a stalemate in the brain while it's trying to shift from a non-crisis state to a crisis state. But usually, as long as they know what the plan is, where they're expected to go, they will actually automatically go into whatever that plan was. So that's why it's so important to be prepared and know, when I get this warning, here's what I'm expected to do.
And Eric, from your perspective as a meteorologist, what do you recommend people do when they hear a tornado warning? Immediately stop what you're doing, just be aware. What should people do?
Yeah, they should immediately stop and right away make sure that they are putting that plan into action. They should also remember how these tornado warnings work. I think a lot of people have been upset that maybe they didn't hear sirens when they were at home and in bed. And we got to remember that the tornado sirens are not designed for people in their houses. They're designed for people outside, which means you should be constantly aware, either with an app on your phone or by watching the news or listening to the radio, to know exactly when and where these strong storms are going to be so that you can make an immediate decision. And that's the key thing, is making the decision automatically and doing it quickly. And honestly, there's some neat research that shows that lengthening tornado warning times much beyond between 15 and 30 minutes could be bad, because people might think they have more time than they really do to make the right moves.
Sure. And Leandra, what should you communicate to kids? I'm curious here how you balance having a plan with maybe giving kids too much information that could cause them some anxiety.
That's a great point. So we try not to give them more than what they need to just get through that moment. So with kids, what you want them to do is look to you. You don't really want them taking ownership of something or feeling like they should be somehow being a hero in that moment. Like, really, they should just know, here's the basic idea of what we're going to do. Grab this and look to mom or dad or whoever I'm with at that moment. And I think the biggest thing is, research shows that however a guardian or, you know, whoever the adult is in the room, however they react, whether it's with fear or courage or whatever you want to say, that is how the child is going to react. So if you think about when they fall off the bike and there's that moment where they look around, they're not sure what they're supposed to do, that's kind of the moment where they're going to look at you. And if you're acting scared, they're going to become scared. So as long as you're calm, they will stay calm.
And how is this different maybe across ages, maybe, you know, your preschooler versus maybe that child in middle school or high school?
Yeah. So in the younger ones, it's just, there's a tornado. This is exactly what we're going to do. Stay with me. With older ones, you do have the ability to give them a kind of a role, take a little bit of control over the situation. Having more control and having a role where they feel helpful is actually really beneficial for long-term recovery.
I'm speaking with Eric Snodgrass, senior atmospheric scientist at AgNutrien, and Leandra Paris, assistant professor of psychology at Illinois State University. We're talking about this tornado season and how to talk about it with your family. How do you talk about tornadoes with your family, especially kids? Give us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Leandra, if a tornado does hit your community or somewhere nearby, seeing the damage from those storms can really be heartbreaking. You know, homes are destroyed, schools, cars. How do you recommend talking to kids about those situations, about what's happened?
So we recommend that you stick to facts. They may have a lot of questions that you weren't prepared for. So kind of think about this ahead of time. If my child asks this, how will I react? Because again, your reaction is probably the biggest thing that's going to influence how they feel and how they think about it. And then just not sugarcoating it, but not giving them more than what they need. So turning off the TV, not letting them see it over and over again, limiting their exposure as much as you can, while also being honest that, yes, this is a tragedy. We couldn't really predict it. You know, it's always kind of hard to say who's going to be affected by it and who's not. What questions do you have? So.
And Leandra, is this these situations at all different for teachers? You know, you're in a classroom trying to manage 25 kids versus parents where you're dealing with your own kids, just a few kids?
Yes. So with parents, I'm always like, control your reactions, stay calm, ask them, you know, do they need shelter? Where they, you know, kind of be there with them in the moment. With teachers, they're controlling, you know, like you said, a whole classroom. It's more of a system. And that's why it's so important that schools do the drills, so that kids know there's a little bit more of a independence that they have to have in that moment. They know to line up, and it's all about getting a system to work as opposed to an individual child. So for teachers, again, staying calm is the number one thing, but also knowing how to respond to a plan if the plan that your district has given you isn't going to work right now, and making sure that you're able to get all of your kids where they need to go, keep them safe, keep them calm, and if they're asking lots of questions, it's okay to say, you know what, right now is not the time, and keep going through the motion.
And Leandra, what are some of the questions you get from adults about how to handle all this?
Usually it's just, how much do I talk about when someone dies or when they get injured? How much detail do I give them? And usually, you know, again, need to know only basis kind of thing. And a lot of it is, how do I control my own emotion when I'm talking about it? So we are affected by this. And when we're talking to kids, sometimes we get very emotional too. So usually I have a bit of a practice run with parents, or I tell them, like, practice what you're going to say before you go in and say it, so that you can control your emotions and kind of keep to what's best for the child.
And Eric, you know, back to you for just a second. I'm curious, you know, what your thoughts are on some of this, maybe especially for those teachers in that classroom setting. What are the most effective ways to not only communicate, but, you know, the effective procedures in place to handle things during storms?
Yeah, you know, good thing is most schools are well built and they're very safe places. And also the times of day when we typically have tornadoes is actually after school. But in the event of that situation, what we just typically look for is a strong leadership out of the teacher. You know, the students will follow and they'll listen if they know that the plan is in place and that they can trust the authority figures. And, you know, minimizing panic and maximizing the plan is, I think, really what teachers would want to focus on.
Leandra, disaster relief is certainly much needed after a flood or a storm. And what's the best way kids can take part so it might be helpful for them emotionally and for the people in need?
Yeah, so in the school systems, we usually have classrooms do cards for people who might be in the hospital, or get well cards for the people in the community, or kind of do like little crafty things where they can kind of give back and kind of have a little bit of their own say in that. We also, whenever we are dealing with it, if we have children who've shown up to the scene, if they're old enough, we might have them running water. We might have them sort of taking stock of where people are. But for the most part, we keep them all together. We give them an activity to keep them busy, and using that to kind of say, well, we're going to help the people who are in need. So why don't we do this card, or why don't we gather up and do a fundraiser or something like that?
Certainly, tornadoes are something you can't control, you can't prevent. With kids, obviously, you want to be able to talk to them as parents and, you know, tell them that you can control some of those bad things and prevent them. Are there any strategies for talking about, you know, natural events like these that are just outside of our control?
I think being honest, we do know that unpredictable events tend to be more traumatic for children versus something that you kind of saw coming. And there's just really not a good way to prepare them for something that you don't know really where it's coming from or if it's even going to happen. And so, like I said, just being honest and saying this isn't something that we can control, but we're doing the best that we can to protect you. And as long as they feel like they're being protected and they have support from the adults in their life and in that moment, then typically they're going to be just fine.
And Eric, you know, some people would argue that people can at least prevent some of the factors that lead to tornadoes when it comes to the discussion of climate change. How much is that a factor in what we're seeing this year, or is that easy to say?
It's very challenging to say, to be honest with you. You know, it's the question becomes is when you're talking to somebody about the impacts of climate change on things like this, severe weather events, you need to understand that our level of scientific understanding on the relationship between climate change and individual tornadoes and what creates them is very low. But what we have to remember is that climate change, what it does is it changes the background state. So weather is the day-to-day variability. Climate change is the average of that. So if you start to adjust or move or shift the background state of the atmosphere, then you change the things that happen on top of it. And so there is a lot of fantastic research that is going in to try to understand what does the next 30 to 100 years look like if we continue to see some of the shifts and adjustments that are going on right now. But it is impossible to blame any individual event on climate change. It's got to look at it from a collective statistical perspective. And it's a challenging conversation to happen because a lot of people want to immediately attribute it to that and they want to make a story about it. But the scientist in me wants to say, let's just step back and make sure we fully understand the two different systems at play here, the climate versus the weather. So it's a difficult conversation to have. And it's one, honestly, that should be had over coffee in about a couple of hours because it takes a while to kind of distill those facts.
Sure. And could you get into just a little bit here what our background state looks like right now and what it might be looking like here down the road with what we're seeing with climate change?
Yeah, well, let's tackle one of the things. One of the things that we often watch most closely is the position and strength of the jet stream. So that is ultimately one of the major controlling factors on all of our weather systems. So if the jet stream is flowing along, meandering a little bit north and south, but coming out of the west, as it does that, if we do anything to increase the amplitude of that, in other words, if the ridges go way far north and the troughs dip way far south, those highly amplified patterns tend to lead to more drought and more flooding, more severe weather, and other problems like that. So one of the things we're trying to understand is, as the Arctic is changing more rapidly than the equator, and we're disrupting the balance between the heat that's over the equator and the cooler weather that's supposed to be over the Arctic, what are we doing to the general waviness of the jet stream? And a lot of research is trying to unpack that, because the more amplified we make that jet stream pattern, the more frequently floods, droughts, severe weather, that stuff is going to happen. And that's kind of the crux of understanding the mid-latitude, you know, where we live here in the United States, the mid-latitude impacts of climate change. And it's regionally dependent, and also depending on where you live with respect to, like, the Great Lakes or the Rocky Mountains or the Gulf of Mexico, it's all going to have a different flavor. But it is one where certainly the background state picking up more heat, warmer ocean temperatures, and as a consequence, more water vapor in the atmosphere, we could just be leading toward a much more highly volatile future in terms of getting these types of events. But it's very, very tricky to distill that down into a forecast for even a given season, because a lot of different factors go into it. Excellent question, though.
Leander, we're just have a minute left here, but I'm wondering, what's the best way to talk to kids about climate change? Not as one big disaster, but it's just this big, slow-moving thing. How do you talk to kids about that?
That would be really difficult. So I was actually thinking one of the ways to prepare them for weather events is to make sure they understand them, which is why education is so important. I know with my son, we just did like a water vortex to help him understand tornadoes, so that we're talking about them so much. I think with something big like this, again, it's sticking to the facts and doing it in simple visual ways to help them understand how that impacts their day-to-day versus, you know, our global perspective. So again, bringing that into the classroom and with parents, educate yourself and talk to them in the most simple terms possible.
Leandra Paris is an assistant professor of psychology at Illinois State University. Eric Snodgrass, the senior atmospheric scientist at Ag Nutrien. Thanks both of us for joining us on the 21st.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, in for Nyla Boodoo. There are more than 840,000 kids in Illinois who are under the age of 5, and nearly 1 in 5 of those kids live in poverty. So what tools do they need to get a good education, and what stands in their way? It might depend on which county you live in. That's according to a new report from the Erickson Institute. It looks at how well children are developing across the state, while also evaluating the different risks they face in their communities. Researchers looked at everything from how housing costs to overdose deaths to violence can impact kids, their education, and their future. The report is called Risk and Reach. It also focuses on how many resources are available in each county and includes policy recommendations to help different counties across Illinois. For more on this report, we're joined now by Christina Passioni-Zayas. She's the director of policy at the Erickson Institute, an education organization focused on early childhood development. Christina, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the report, can I just ask you, how important is having data on early childhood education when it comes to evaluating how our education system is doing as a whole?
Incredibly important. It's super significant to know where we stand today, to kind of have a baseline analysis of how young children are developing to inform our decisions, not only at the policy level, but also at the resource allocation level. So this type of report is incredibly helpful because it is a snapshot and it's comprehensive. It covers health, it covers family stability, as well as early care and education. And then an analysis of the fiscal resources that we as a state dedicate to child development.
What do we know about the impact that our education and family life at a young age have on our future as we grow up?
Well, we know that the first 5 years of life literally set the trajectory for your human experience. 90% of the brain is formed in the first 5 years, and literally the early experiences that you have particularly in the first 3 years of life, literally get under your skin. They form the architecture of your brain and really kind of set you up either for success or for some additional challenges and burdens. So focusing on the first 5 years are super important for our state with respect to all of the sectors that contribute to human development.
Wow, that's a pretty amazing statistic right there. And I'm assuming that's part of why the Erickson Institute wanted to do this research.
Absolutely. There had been a few other states that have issued risk and reach reports and have had some success in being able to educate and inform our policy leaders in a way that's based on analysis and research so that they can really better allocate resources so that they're more equitably distributed and they're more effective in their distribution. And so we came together with two other partners, the Illinois Early Childhood Asset Map of the University of Illinois at Urbana, as well as Voices for Illinois Children, their Fiscal Policy Center. Five funders came together, led by Irving Harris Foundation, to really kind of seed this project so that we can, you know, have the resources to do this comprehensive look. I think what distinguishes us from other states is that we have 32 indicators that we're looking at, 15 of them focused on risk factors, 17 on the reach of public resources, plus a fiscal scan. Most states usually only do about like 12 to 15 indicators.
Okay. Well, getting into the report, let's get into some of these early experiences that affect kids' lives. One of the things you measured was child well-being. To do that, you were looking at three different things: family stability, health, and early care. Let's start with family stability. What sort of risk factors fall into that category?
You have everything from maternal education to parental employment, housing cost burden, homelessness, maltreatment. These are all of the research-based indicators that really kind of, you think about the comprehensive support a young child needs to be set up for success. These are what these indicators represent.
And let's talk about how these things impact young children. I certainly, something like homelessness might be obvious in terms of impact, but maybe not something like what level of education that your mother has.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, we put together a 40-person advisory council that represented public and private leaders across the state. And for us, as we were selecting risk indicators, we needed something that was going to be based in the research. And maternal education is one of the leading predictors of a child's outcome. And it's not to say that, you know, a parent needs or particularly a mother needs a college education. It's really all of the other circumstantial experiences that happen when you do have higher education, meaning that you might be more aware about the health needs of your child and how to access those resources and how to advocate on your child's behalf in a school setting. If you yourself have some challenges with learning and have challenges with accessing resources, it's going to be that much more difficult to get your child what they need to have themselves set up for success.
You also looked at health. Risk factors in this category are things like exposure to violence, preterm births, maternal morbidity. What did you find when it came to where the resources for health issues were located geographically? Did you find there were more in urban or rural areas, for example?
Well, I mean, I think just overall, because it's so comprehensive and you look at all the indicators, it's difficult to say that there's a particular trend for a specific domain. And when I say domain, I'm talking about either the family stability, the health, or the early care and education. What's really important to pay attention to is that the risk factors move all across our state in all kinds of geographies and disrupt assumptions in different ways, as well as the distribution of resources. What we thought was kind of interesting, for example, some people may think that violence is only concentrated, you know, in Cook County and the collar counties, but you actually see it across the state. I mean, the state average was 436 violent crimes per 100,000 individuals in a given population. And I mean, that's pretty high when you think about it. And the type of circumstances that are created are conditions of toxic stress that children are exposed to. Maternal morbidity was another really interesting one to look at, particularly as it relates to when you disaggregate the data by race, ethnicity. We really wanted to, when data was available, disaggregate these experiences as well as the distribution of resources by racial and ethnic subgroups so that we can then illuminate perhaps different strategies for how we might deploy resources to mitigate these risk factors.
Looking at services specifically, did it seem like certain areas of the state had better access to services than others, or that it really varied county to county?
It really did vary county to county. I mean, I think, you know, if we go back to, for example, maltreatment, it was kind of interesting. Again, another assumption that people may have, and when I'm talking about maltreatment, I'm talking about indicated reports of children who have been abused or neglected. And this was a rate of per 1,000 children 0 to 5. Where you saw some interesting cases is that you had a higher risk or experiences of this in the central and western region of the state. But then when you look at the companion reach, which is permanency, when you reunite children who are in the welfare system with their families and have a permanent place after 12 months, you actually saw a greater reach in those same areas where they were struggling with the risk factors. So, I mean, it just kind of varies depending on what you're looking at, particularly in terms of the indicators.
Which areas of our state do we consistently see with less access across the different categories?
Overall, what was kind of interesting to observe is the southern region. There were higher concentrations of risk and less access. But I would just say, in general, one thing I kind of want to say overarching across our state is that 81% of the counties rated as high risk on at least one indicator. Mm-hmm. But what was really interesting is that 75% of the counties that were considered high risk had at least two low or low moderate risks in one of the 15 indicators. So that was 9 out of 12 counties. They still, and what I want to just drive home is that while a county may be experiencing a concentration of risk factors, it doesn't mean that it's doom and gloom. It means that there is probably some good things going on there. And that's why a really important message for us with this report is that all data needs to be contextualized by local leadership. When you look at county level data, it's kind of blunt. And there might be corners of different counties that are pushing that data in a particular direction. And therefore, it's really important that local leaders help to give you a little bit more context and depth in terms of how we interpret the data and then also how we come up with the solutions to mitigate these risks or to bring in new resources to support child development.
What will having more data like this allow us to do as a state? What do you hope people will take away from this report?
Well, we worked really hard to make the data accessible. You know, as an academic institution, sometimes you get kind of caught up in your bubbles and you speak your jargon and you only kind of talk to other academics. And so for us, that's why it was really important in the creation of the report that we involved not only your policy leaders, but we also involved advocates and we also involved local leaders and beneficiaries of these particular programs so that we can ensure that the data is actionable. It just doesn't sit on a shelf and we look at some pretty maps and say, wow, that's interesting. But it actually informs and serves as a blueprint to help us understand how can we better and more effectively distribute resources so that we are supporting young children. We take kind of this anti-colonial stance as an academic institution in that it's not our place to interpret the data. It's just our place to present the data and help facilitate dialogues that really generate inquiry and discussion as well as action.
Want to just go back for a second. The last category here is early care and education. One of the things you looked at there was kindergarten readiness, and that's something we've talked about on the 21st before. Your report showed that more than 75% of Illinois kindergartners did not demonstrate readiness. What does that term mean?
Sure. So the state has mandated a assessment called the KIDS assessment. It's the Kindergarten Individual Development Survey. And so the idea is that it's 14 domains, that represent various areas of development for kindergartners. And it what this particular assessment looks at is that you have to meet as a kindergartner in your 40th day, three out of the kind of four main areas that they're looking at. And so what this particular assessment demonstrated is that nearly three quarters of our kindergartners are not meeting those particular thresholds. And because it's an individual assessment, it's supposed to inform kindergarten teachers about how they can differentiate support for these kindergartners throughout not only kindergarten, but the early years. And so it's in its, I want to say this is, we just completed the second year of implementation. I mean, it had been piloted for many years. And so I think overall as a state, we're still trying to work out how do we implement this in a way that's effective and get data right back to teachers so that they can actually use it. But it's still sort of a work in progress. What you kind of notice, though, is that if you go through the years, because the other two indicators that we have in there and the risk factors is the PARC assessment in terms of language arts and math, and roughly between 60 to 63% for language arts and for math are not meeting or exceeding. So KIDS allows us to kind of get an early temperature check on what we have to do to support young children so that when they actually get to the third grade and it becomes high stakes and it is actually contributing to the school report card, we're not like shocked. It's meant to really sort of be an early alert and warning, but also to build upon the strengths that young children bring.
You know, you mentioned at the beginning of this conversation that what happens during the first 5 years of life affects so much of the rest of your life. What do you hope listeners who aren't researching this every day take away from that? I mean, I'm guessing you don't want them to think that that means, well, there's nothing that can be done after they hit age five.
No, I think it's just a reorientation. I mean, we have to think about what happens prenatally, what happens preconceptually, and how do we better support families in those early years? Because I think what's really important is that we don't think of children just as sort of like a widget or an independent individual. Children are learning and growing up in the context of relationships, systems, and structures. And so it's really important that when we're thinking about supporting children, we're thinking about supporting families and caregivers, because essentially children are the well-being of our communities. They are sort of that barometer. If the children are well, the caregivers, the parents that are taking care of them are also well. The environment around them is safe, thriving. And so it's really about how do we refocus our energy and attention so that we set children up for success prior to school entry, and we use communities to support that effort, and that policy leaders actually are on the ground with our community leaders helping to better coordinate and organize resources.
We've been discussing a report called Risk and Reach, published by the Erickson Institute, and we've been discussing it with Christina Passione-Zayas, the Director of Policy at the Erickson Institute. Christina, thank you so much for joining us today on the 21st.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And just a note, we'll tweet out Christina's report if you follow us on Twitter at 21STShow. What is TV trivia drama for $2.4 million? If you follow Jeopardy, you're likely familiar with University of Illinois graduate and professional sports gambler James Holzhauer, who's been on a 32-game winning streak on the show. But yesterday, he fell short of breaking the all-time Jeopardy record. Who broke his winning streak? 27-year-old University of Chicago librarian Emma Betcher.
So, Emma, it's up to you. If you came up with the correct response, you're going to be the new Jeopardy champion. Did you? You did. What did you wager? Oh, gosh, $20,000. What a payday. $46,801. What a game. Oh, my gosh. What a way to start the week.
And Betcher wrote her paper for her master's in information science on, quote, predicting the difficulty of trivia questions using text features. Holzhauer ended his Jeopardy run with $2.4 million in winnings, just short of the record of $2.5 million set by Ken Jennings. Coming up after the break, we'll be speaking with Alex Panko, who climbed Mount Everest. He's back in Chicago after a deadly climbing season. We'll talk with him about his experience. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Moline, in for Nyla Boodoo. Alex Panko has climbed some of the world's tallest peaks, and the native of Highland Park recently summited the tallest of them all, Mount Everest, just a couple of weeks ago. But he happened to be there during one of the busiest and deadliest climbing seasons on record at Mount Everest. Every year, an average of 5 climbers die making the journey. This year, though, the number of deaths has about doubled. Alex is on the line with us now to discuss what may account for this rise and talk about what it's like to journey up Mount Everest. Alex, thanks so much for joining us. Welcome to the 21st.
Brian, thanks for having me.
Before we get into your recent experience at Everest, I understand this is one of several extremely tall mountains that you've climbed. Could you talk a little bit about the Explorer's Grand Slam that you're working toward?
Right. So the Explorer's Grand Slam is something about, the version I'm doing, which is called The Last Degree. About 45 people in the world have done it. 15 Americans, and it's climbing the 7 summits, which is the highest mountain on each continent, and then cross-country skiing the last degree to both the North and South Pole. And beyond that, involving training, I've probably done about 15 major mountains around the world.
Wow. The vast majority of people would never even attempt this, of course, or even think that they could do it. What made you feel like that you could climb Mount Everest?
You know, it's really funny. You could have thrown me in there. I had no idea I was going to climb Mount Everest. I needed a different challenge in my life, and I went to Africa on a safari, and I loved it. And so kind of inner Hemingway called out, and I wanted to go climb Kilimanjaro. So I wasn't sure I could do it. People doubted me. I'd never done anything like that. I worked harder than I ever had, and I didn't necessarily think I'd make it. But when I did, you know, that's when I started to say, hey, you know, you haven't even considered you can do this, so let's see how far we can take this.
And after Kilimanjaro, what sort of training did you have to do to get ready then to climb Mount Everest?
Well, I'm lucky. I work with a company called Uphill Athlete. They're the best of the best. I work out back in Chicago over 20 hours a week. It's 2 half marathons a week, 3 10Ks, a lot of core, hours in a stairwell with a lot of weight. And the real key is getting high production at a low heart rate, because you can't get your heart rate into an anaerobic state at high altitude. There's just not enough oxygen. So really we focused on, you know, getting times, half marathon times, to around 90 minutes with a low heart rate of around 140.
Wow. And I just have to go back for a second here. I run half marathons. I do about 3 or 4 a year. You're saying you do 2 every week?
2 a week, 3 10Ks. It's funny, I'm not a runner. I've actually never run a marathon, and these guys are miracle workers, because I kind of got up the first several summits really just not knowing how to train and pushing mentally, and I was really quite deficient. And so they took over in 2018 in January working with me, and the results have been pretty incredible.
I guess so. And I should say this process is nothing like just going on a regular hike by yourself. There are lots of people involved in something like this. Who helps you along the way on a summit of Everest?
Right. Well, first off, I'll tell you, and you'll get into this in a bit, a reputable company like Adventure Consultants, we made a roadmap, not to make sure I was in just physical shape, but technical shape. So I've climbed everything from 14ers in Colorado training to the 6th highest mountain in the world, Kilauea, which was a 4-week climb in Tibet, and my first time in the Death Zone. So there's lots of technical expertise that goes into it. Now, on a climb like Denali, which I'm going for the second time next week, you're very, very much on your own. You have to carry everything and kind of do everything on your own. On Everest, nothing would be possible without the logistics and support of a top-tier guide, the top-tier Sherpas who go with us. You know, you need oxygen up there, you need supplies, you need food, you need tents, and quite simply put, carrying things at that sort of elevation on your own is a tremendous ordeal, and so it would not be possible without their incredible expertise, from fixing the ropes to bringing up oxygen with you. They make it possible.
As we mentioned earlier, Alex, this has certainly been an especially deadly year at Mount Everest. Is that something that you concerned you as you were getting ready to do this?
You know, so first off, it's expected. You know, the crowding thing is not actually that new. The reality is, last year they had almost as many climbers and they had no crowding issues because they had about 11 good days to summit. You know, that's not always the case. And especially as the year went on this year, it became apparent we were not going to get one of these big windows and be able to necessarily spread out. So we knew that crowding could be an issue. We also know that deaths are going to be an issue. The reality is, statistically, for every 100 climbers that make the top, two will die. So, you know, you had 800 climbers or so summit this year. You expected around 8 deaths, which isn't to say I sound heartless. You know, I knew the two Americans who died. I summited the day after one of them died. You know, I was kind of in the middle of that. You see bodies, you step over bodies, and you know that's part of it. But I would say, and I pointed this out, it's not necessarily the crowding that's the problem. We had on our summit day probably over 100 people go for the summit, but we didn't experience crowds because it was really good guide operators with really strong clients. The problem isn't a quantity thing. It's a quality thing where there's a lot of cheaper operators and people, they accept people who shouldn't be there, and people don't seem to really want to pony up the extra money that could save their life or the extra training or the extra expertise.
Alex, I just want to back up here. You know, you mentioned that you know going into this that basically 2 out of every 100 people who make this climb aren't going to make it back alive. How do you deal with something like that mentally?
It's really hard. You know, so I personally knew it could happen, but my guide told me ahead of time, when we see this happen, it's going to be very different. You know, just to emphasize, we stayed back because we saw this kind of coming on the 22nd. There were a bunch of budget operators, and we saw their clients lower on the mountain. And we said, this is not a group we want to be going up with. So when we went up the night of the 22nd at 10 p.m., I kind of knew that there was going to be something going on when I saw headlamps high up on the mountain. It said people were still up there from the night before. And sure enough, as we went, you know, they bring down bodies, people barely alive, one after another. And it does rattle you. There's no denying it. The one thing that kind of keeps your head in the game is you're very hypoxic at that time. And so you're kind of just dragging your own feet along, not really entirely in the moment.
You know, quite a few people do make it to the top. I understand it's on the way back down. It can actually be more dangerous because of altitude sickness. Is that right?
Right. So, you know, I made it. First off, you know, I collapsed on the Hillary step about 20 minutes from the top. My regulator gave out, so I wasn't getting any oxygen. Luckily, because I went with Adventure Consultants, which is a great operator, they had a backup. But that kind of sapped me a little bit. You know, your heart's racing, you're panicking. And that's the first time I got up to the summit very strong, and on the way down, I deteriorated really fast. Everyone kind of does. You don't realize just being up there. You think you're going strong. And just being above 8,000 meters, your body's wasting away. Your mental capabilities are just wasting away. And I was very lucky. I actually learned when I got down I had an pneumonia, and it was just developing at just the right time that I was able to get to the top and make it down under my own power. But, yeah, you hallucinate. You see things. And every single second I had to tell myself, focus on each step, you need to make it down.
What are some of the other big dangers when it comes to climbing Everest that you had to prepare for?
The ice fall at the bottom. You have to go up and down, you know, the mountain 3 times to acclimate and then summit. The ice fall, the most dangerous section, is one of those areas, doesn't matter how good of a climber you are, you have very limited control. You see rocks go rocketing past you. There's giant seracs the size of houses that'll just collapse. I didn't have one collapse on me, so to speak, but you'd be going back through the route and you'd say, where's the fixed rope? And you'd realize it's just sitting under these massive chunks of ice. And if you had been there when that had happened, that would be very, very, very difficult. Other than that, we had tons of physical dangers, but the mental aspect, being away from home for 2 months, having just a handful, maybe 3 or 4 showers over 2 months. The food's good at base camp, but up above that on the mountains, not great food, and you don't really feel like eating. And just sitting around waiting, you know, it's hard. That might be the hardest thing, is there's a lot of time to process things. And when you hear about people dying and, oh, I met this person and they're not coming down, it's not like you're doing a physical activity where you can just push it to the back of your mind. A lot of the times you're just sitting there for a week thinking about that. So the patience and the mental parts are probably the hardest part for me.
Yeah, why do you think there has been an increase in deaths on Everest this year? Is it mostly a product of that shorter window that there was this year?
Well, you know, I think the two Americans had natural causes. I'm not an expert on whether that was up there for being too long or not. But what I will say, to be blunt, is there's a problem with China and India, where you have huge groups of these people who are incentivized, sometimes financially by the state, certainly from a glory perspective. I know that people in India in the military who climb Everest get special recognition and promotions, and they're just not prepared. And like I said, you know, they're paying $30,000 versus $60,000, and what they're giving up, you don't necessarily need more than two bottles of oxygen. But it's nice going up with three or four, so if something goes wrong, you have that option. And they just aren't getting the experience. You know, realistically, Everest is expensive, but the time commitment to really prepare for it, spending, in my case, 2 to 3 years climbing around the world, and the finances to fly and travel all these places, it's a huge investment. And I think people get so obsessed with Everest that they don't appreciate the journey. They just care about getting to the top. And the real journey is being self-sufficient and going with a good team if something goes wrong, but being very capable on your own. And, you know, I almost went for Everest last year, and I took another year to go do Chiloyu, and I'm happy. I appreciate the journey and working that much harder for it. It meant that much more getting to the top.
With the number of people attempting the climb this season, did you feel at all conflicted about adding to the number of people on the mountain?
Did I feel conflicted about the number of people on it?
Yeah, about adding to the number of people since it was already such a big number.
Like I said, I think it's more of a quality over quantity thing. We had a good amount of climbers going for the summit, aren't we? And like I said, it was a, you know, kind of really good guide companies, or the guides all talked together. They actually coordinated the times leaving Camp Fork, so we wouldn't just run into each other the entire way. So I'm not going to tell anyone that they should or shouldn't climb Everest, but I do think if you immediately required people to have a certain level of expertise, you know, a lot of people who wouldn't, because again, to really get there, you don't need 6 months or a year of training. You need years of training, years of working hard. You need to test yourself at 8,000 meters. That way you learn on a mountain like Chiloyu, which is safer. You're going to learn if you have any physiological problems, such as a heart ailment, maybe in a situation where if something goes wrong, you can get on down. So I think if you really appreciate the journey and put in the time and dues, there's going to be less people, which it is frustrating when you see people being hauled up by guides and they're getting to the top and they're not, they might get there and they might get down, but they're not doing it on their own. No one's doing it on their own, but really, you know, they're not even walking on their own. And that certainly, I think, takes away from mountaineers who really put in their dues.
Before we go, Alex, I understand you're raising money for cancer research through these climbs. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, so I'm doing the Explorers Grant, so I'm trying to raise $1 million for pediatric brain tumor research at Lurie Children's. I was a patient there. It's a fantastic, fantastic hospital. You know, everyone in the state and a lot of the nation knows what Lurie's is, and they're really a results-oriented hospital. So each climb is dedicated to a current or former patient. I'm dedicating my final climb, Denali, to a girl named Abby, who is unfortunately no longer here. We're dedicating it to her memory. I read about her story during Brain Tumor Awareness Month, and it really touched me. She basically just kept on living her life and being energetic until the very end. So I think it's very appropriate that I dedicate it to her. So we're just shy of $500,000. It's all small donations, and you can go to my site, peaksofmind.org. You can also follow me, Peaks of Mind Official, on Instagram, and there'll be links there. And I'd really like to get to $500,000. Again, it's so great when I see people donating $50, $100 and sending messages saying, oh, family member of mine or someone I know is treated at Lurie's. So I'm really hoping to get there in kind of a grassroots way, and we're not that far off from $500,000, which is a huge milestone.
Wonderful. Alex Panko from Chicago area, who just climbed Mount Everest this spring. Alex, thank you so much for joining us here on the 21st.
All right. Thank you for having me.
You bet. And again, that website he just mentioned, peaksofmind.org, if you'd like to take a look. That's all the time we have for today. And you can follow us on Twitter. Just search for 21STShow. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background of what we're discussing. On our Facebook page, you can search for The 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want to ask on air. All of those links, every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us on social media, just go to our website. That's 21stshow.org. We've also got all of our past shows there. You can also find us most places you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify now, as well as Apple Podcasts and NPR One. Just search for The 21st. We're produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montecelio, who's our senior producer. Eunice Alpazon and Jasper Davidoff are our interns. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Moline, in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.